Right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this session on TB HIV management in high HIV prevalence settings from coordination to integration. You have two chairs for this session, myself, I'm Tony Harris. I work currently for the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease, and before that spent many years working in Africa, largely Malawi. And Eric Gomer, who's with me, who is medical coordinator for Médecins Sans Frontières in South Africa, who also has a long experience of working in Africa. Dr. Jeremiah Chakaya, I'm afraid, couldn't be here to attend this meeting. Before we start with the presentations, I would like to try and briefly set the scene. TB-HIV, as someone once said, and from the point of view of us humans, was a marriage made in hell about 30 years ago. And if we look at the most recent status for this marriage, data for 2008, of the 9.4 million people who were infected in that year and developed the disease tuberculosis, 1.4 million were co-infected with HIV. 80% of those people, adults and children, live in sub-Saharan Africa. And 50% of those people, adults and children, in fact, live in just 9 countries in southern Africa. Of these 1.4 million co-infected patients, 520,000 lost their lives during anti-tuberculosis treatment, giving a case fatality of about 40%. Far too many deaths for a disease, tuberculosis, that should be curable. Our response during the first 25 years of this TB-HIV epidemic was slow, it was timid, and it was uncoordinated. There are various reasons for this, but the chief reason, which some years back was so eloquently articulated by Kevin de Kock, was really the different philosophies of the two programs. HIV-AIDS programs focusing on human rights, focusing on HIV prevention and on HIV testing. TB programs being public health based and focused on finding the cases and treating them. From 2004, 3 events came to try and bring these two programs together. Firstly, there was a WHO policy document outlining the collaborative activities needed to reduce the joint burden of TB and HIV. A 15-page document that has to be commended for its clarity and for its direction. Secondly, the advent of antiretroviral treatment of crucial importance to the two programs, and especially now if we look at antiretroviral treatment for preventing HIV transmission and for preventing HIV-associated tuberculosis. And thirdly, the spread of 2 deadly forms of tuberculosis, multidrug-resistant tuberculosis and extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis, both of which are facilitated by HIV. However, despite the need to collaborate and the strategies in place, we really do not do this well enough, especially from the HIV side. We don't think tuberculosis and we don't act on tuberculosis. So this session is going to discuss these issues. We're going to focus largely on the problem in sub-Saharan Africa. I think we're very lucky, very privileged to have 4 highly experienced and excellent speakers who know this field very well. And they will look at the TB-HIV issue from the point of view of the community patient perspective, the operations perspective, the scientific perspective, and finally, the policy perspective. The way we're going to run this session is that speakers will speak one after the other for about 12 to 15 minutes, and that then leaves us 30 minutes for discussion. It's a big room, but I ask you, please, don't be shy. Come and ask your questions and come and challenge us, basically to ask us, prod us to how we're going to do better. The title of this symposium is provocative, From Coordination to Integration. We don't coordinate well enough. Can we really think of integration. So with that in mind, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, who is Lucy Chizier, who's a nutritionist by profession and a leading international advocate who's played a crucial role in spurring awareness worldwide of the dangers of TB-HIV co-infection. She's a member of many international advisory groups on TB-HIV. And for her work in TB-HIV, last year was awarded the prestigious Cochon Prize from the Stop TB Partnership. Lucy, we welcome you.
Thank you very much, Chair, for giving me this opportunity. And I just want to assure you that I think TB, I dream TB, and I always talk about TB-HIV all the time. I'm here today, and apologies just in case you're not able to hear me. I'm having a bad flu. I just came in about 4 days ago, and having an AC in the room really has messed up my immune system. And so apologies for those who won't be able to hear me. I'm happy to share the community perspective of coordination to integration, more so having experienced the challenges of having gone through TB-HIV co-infection, but always looking at it as an opportunity that basically provided me the opportunity to be able to start antiretroviral therapy. The outline of my presentation is going to look at what's the background like, what are the benefits of TB-HIV integration, what are some of the challenges and consequences, what is needed, and maybe just give one or two examples of some current TB-HIV strategies that have been undertaken by communities. When we look back, we actually realize that despite 30 years of a TB-HIV marriage, efforts to tackle the TB-HIV have been largely separate for years, despite having evidence of the overlapping epidemiology. We've basically also seen that the HIV and AIDS epidemic has undermined the progress in TB control, and we can also say the same for TB. But what strikes me most is the lack of the integration that basically provides an opportunity to be able to not scale up at the right pace that we basically think of talking about. I'm more than happy to share two quotes, one by the Minister of Health, South Africa, who said that the dual epidemic of TB-HIV is the most single important public health challenge of our time. And more so, also looking at what Francis Opina, one of the TB-HIV advocates from Kenya, says, which is, if we actually treated TB in people living with HIV and AIDS, at the end of the day, we'll be able to save over 5,000 lives on a day-to-day basis. From my own country, Kenya, where I come from, there are two things that we have seen drive the TB epidemic. One is poverty, and the other is HIV and AIDS. But more so, when we look back and take stock, it's good that we have some of the policies that have been clearly spelled out. And I just want to draw your attention to the policy that talks about community involvement in the management of HIV-infected TB patients. How can communities better get engaged in terms of accelerating efforts so that we are better placed to be able to address the TB-HIV epidemic? And also the aspect of how do we scale up people living with HIV and AIDS support groups so that they can get engaged in TB activities, so that at the end of the day, it's all partners who are basically on the table realizing that we have a common problem, two diseases in one patient, and how are we working towards ensuring that we have universal access for TB-HIV co-infected patients. Now, what are some of the benefits of basically having an opportunity to be able to integrate services? And I want to say this from a patient's perspective is it basically provides access to a continuum of prevention, care, treatment, services. Identifying TB early among people living with HIV and AIDS, we know very well, and statistics show us, it's going to help reduce morbidity and also mortality at the same time. What about sustaining life? Because we know at the end of the day, we've seen the tragedy whereby somebody is initiated on antiretroviral therapy, you fail to screen them for TB within a short span of time, you basically have lost them. You can imagine the amount of money that has been spent trying to sustain that person on antiretroviral therapy. And yet here we are committing a suicide of not providing the opportunity for screening TB, and this would make a huge difference in terms of guaranteeing the continuity of that person's life. And then thirdly, also the ability to be able to provide an opportunity for patients who are basically smear negative. What is the added advantage of actually being able to initiate them on IPT so that at the end of the day you're able to prevent them from developing tuberculosis? From the community perspective, we have identified challenges of TB-HIV integration. And one thing that strikes me most when I go out there to the community is that basic lack of information. People are not aware that once you go to the healthcare facility, then you need to be screened for TB as a person living with HIV. What about the double stigma that exists? Many a times when I attend the support groups, there have been treatment literacy programs that have been initiated for people living with HIV and AIDS. But when you look at treatment literacy programs for TB-HIV co-infected patients or even per se TB patients, it's basically missing. Also, the other issue is the minimal engagement of PLHA networks in advocacy for better new tools. We know the reality on the ground that we need new drugs, new diagnostics, and most importantly, a TB vaccine. But how are we engaging networks of people living with HIV and AIDS around the world to be able to bring up some of the challenges that are on the ground and using that basically as an opportunity to be able to scale up TB-HIV services? What about programmatic responses? Many a times, HIV and AIDS programs have moved pretty fast. You'll find that once you walk into a HIV program, they identify if there are challenges in relation to socioeconomic status, then there are income-generating activities that have been initiated. Have we done that for TB and HIV? I don't think so. Have we done that for TB patients? I don't think so, too. And from the community perspective, the other thing is, many a times in most countries, except maybe one or two countries like South Africa, Kenya, Rwanda, you'd look at two programs being headed by different people. So you have an issue on TB-HIV, you want to go and see the AIDS program manager, he refers you to the TB program manager. But at the end of the day, things are even worsened when you realize that these two programs are basically being funded by different people, and many a times even that funding does not consider what community groups can actually do to be able to address the dual epidemic. And then, of course, the other challenge is the aspect whereby there is the lacking quality data in relation to what communities have basically done when it comes to scaling up TB-HIV. Now, some of the consequences that I just want to highlight are the lack of comprehensive care for TB-HIV patients. Separate clinics have a huge impact on patients who are attending two different dates, and the time wasted in relation to coming to one clinic on Monday, being able to come to another clinic on Thursday. So at the end of the day, having a one-stop shop would go a long way in ensuring that patients are able to go about their day-to-day activities and be able to continue their productivity and be able to provide for their families. Lack of coordination also results in straining healthcare facilities, because at the end of the day, you find healthcare workers who are pretty overwhelmed, and yet that's a missed opportunity for sure. The lost opportunity also for intensified case finding for TB among people living with HIV is another consequence. And then, of course, lastly, where healthcare workers are pretty overwhelmed. I just want to pause here and ask about four questions. What can we do to increase availability of TB-HIV integrated services in the countries that we work in? What can we do to reduce the stigma that is basically associated with TB-HIV? What are some of the barriers, and what can we do to address them? How can we increase demand for TB-HIV services? And of most importantly, how do we increase the profile and even funding for TB-HIV services? At this point, I just want to share some of the successful strategies that have been used by some community patient groups like the Treatment Action Group that has done a lot of work in Africa in collaboration with TB-HIV patients in terms of research advocacy and looking at what are some of the R&D needs and how is that being used and as an opportunity to be able to profile TB internationally and also advocate for more resources. I want to talk about an assessment that was done by the National Empowerment Network of People Living with HIV and AIDS in Kenya. And they basically tried to look at what's going on in relation to implementation of TB-HIV services in Kenya and what are some of the findings that can actually be used to be able to influence policy, advocacy, and even in-country action. Documentation of best practice on TB-HIV by organizations like Target TB that work in India, they work in Swaziland, and just putting that human face and saying this is what TB-HIV patients are actually doing at country level. Engaging champions in TB-HIV at all levels and making sure that patients are represented when we are looking at the community coordinating bodies for TB-HIV from the national level all the way to the district level as agents of change, as watchdogs, as champions that can be able to influence policy and can be able to actually look at what national policies exist and be able to track TB-HIV collaborative activities. In ending, I just want to share about three pictures. One is this is a TB patient that was being counseled in Nairobi in one of the healthcare facilities while accessing, initiating antiretroviral therapy. And then, of course, the big question we really need to ask from here is what do we need to do better so that at the end of the day, we have more and more community action? And I just want to propose some good few ideas. One is how do we scale up treatment literacy programs that are basically going to promote adherence and community information on TB? How can we accelerate advocacy by networks of people living with HIV in all countries where we know TB-HIV is a huge problem? How do we roll out good practice in terms of TB-HIV advocacy and programming? Documentation exists, but are we really using that at country level to be able to scale up initiative? It's important to think about building the capacity of people living with HIV and AIDS so that they are better well-placed to advocate mainstream TB-HIV services into their activities. And then funding opportunities for community groups many a times is forgotten. And how do we think about using IT to be able to promote access to TB-HIV information and adherence? Mobile clinics for TB-HIV so that if we have 1,000 TB sites that are offering TB diagnosis and treatment, how do we mainstream HIV into those programs and ensure that as a patient in wherever community that you are, you're able to access TB-HIV services, that you don't have to be referred from one clinic to the other? And then, of course, joint monitoring processes that need to be established and defaulter prevention programs so that at the end of the day, we are all working towards prevention of multidrug-resistant TB, which pretty scares me because in the country that I come from, we are having now a co-infection rate of MDR and HIV at 22%, which is not a small number. In ending, that's a picture that was taken by stakeholders in Kenya that brought together community patient groups, the HIV program and the TB program, to design a strategy for the country so that we can be able to all work together to ensure that TB-HIV is well taken care of. So let me leave that to you. But the biggest thing is let's basically work together to eliminate the 21st century of TB-HIV genocide. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lucy. So we'll move on to our next speaker, who is Gilles Van Cutsem. Gilles is a medical doctor, epidemiologist and activist working with Médecins Sans Frontières for 12 years. He's been with the Kalisha Project in Cape Town, South Africa for 7 years, was coordinator of that project for the last 3 years, and is head of MSF operations in South Africa. He's basically involved with piloting new models of care for HIV, TB, and drug-resistant TB. Gilles, most welcome.
Thank you. So Lucy has very well outlined why we need TB-HIV integration, and also the fact that even though there is a lot of talk about TB-HIV integration, in reality, there is very little TBHF integration in the field. If you are sitting here, it's probably because you know TB and HIV together is double trouble. In HIV-positive patients, the risk of TB is up to 26 times higher. HIV patients die from TB. TB is the first cause of mortality. TB deteriorates more rapidly in HIV-positive patients, and it is more difficult to diagnose in HIV-positive patients with more smear negative, more extrapulmonary TB. TB also makes HIV evolve more rapidly towards AIDS. And there are many challenges in treating co-infected patients. The pill burden is higher. There's interactions between antiretroviral drugs and TB drugs, mainly rifampicin. There is joint toxicity. There is the immune reconstitution syndrome. You have often deterioration of TB after initiation of ARVs, leading to a very difficult differential diagnostics. And then we still don't know exactly when to start ART in patients with TB. And most importantly, we have much less time in HIV-positive patients to diagnose TB and to start treatment of TB. We have to be much faster because TB deteriorates much quicker in HIV-positive patients and goes quicker towards hospitalization and death. What do we aim for by integrating TB and HIV services? Well, first of all, to decrease mortality and morbidity, and secondly, to improve efficiency of services. At the moment, in many, many clinics, you are duplicating efforts. You have on one side a TB clinic, on another side an HIV clinic, and patients are waiting one day in your TB clinic, the other day they're waiting in your HIV clinic. You're not only wasting your patient's time, you're also wasting very scarce human resources by duplicating many tasks done by healthcare workers. In addition, by integrating TB and HIV services, you also improve clinical skills in TB staff in terms of diagnosing and treating HIV-related conditions, and in people who are used to deal only with HIV into managing TB better. More specifically, what are the objectives of TB and HIV integration? One, to increase testing amongst TB clients so that they can access antiretroviral therapy. Two, to diagnose TB disease earlier in HIV-infected people. Three, to reduce delay to antiretroviral therapy for co-infected patients, and so to decrease mortality linked to the delay in starting. Comprehensive care for co-infected patients. It's one patient with two diseases, so we have to manage them in one program by creating a one-stop service. And then also to improve TB outcomes for co-infected patients by using the tools for adherence support that have shown to work so well with antiretroviral therapy. They can be used to improve outcomes, specifically adherence in TB treatment as well. And then lastly, we aim at using the public health experience of the TB programs into standardizing the approach and the monitoring of ARV patients. This is a picture of, it's a before after picture. This is the TB clinic, and there was a wall there, and then you had the HIV clinic in Khayelitsha in 2003, and patients were going the first day to the, and you must know in Khayelitsha 70% of patients with TB are co-infected with HIV, and up to 50% of patients starting ARVs have TB. So they are the same patients. We broke the wall between the two clinics and started to integrate. And this is what you have now. It's called the Ubuntu Clinic. It is one clinic where TB and HIV are treated together. TB-HIV integration is not TB-HIV collaboration. One of the biggest barriers, I think, in the previous years is that WHO was talking about collaboration between TB and HIV services. Collaborating means still having one TB clinic and one HIV clinic with separate folders containing separate clinical information, leading to often lack of information on TB when you are in the HIV clinic, lack of information of HIV when you are in the other clinic, still duplication of staff, and still these two different programs that are imposing different cultures. What we talk about when we talk about TB-HIV integration is complete integration. One clinic with your same patient seeing one or the same nurse for TB and HIV, the same clerk for TB and HIV, the same doctor for TB and HIV, one folder, one register, one administrative system, and hopefully one day one national TB-HIV program, and maybe once one WHO TB-HIV program. What's the impact of TB and HIV integration that we have seen, not just in Khayelitsha, but also in rural areas, in Lesotho, in South Africa? Well, first of all, there's an improvement of TB-HIV indicators. More TB patients are getting tested for HIV. More HIV-positive patients with TB are getting cotrimoxazole. More HIV-positive patients do have a CD4 count taken, and more HIV-positive patients are started on ART. In addition, the proportion of smear-negative TB increases. And if you, this is data from Lesotho, the MSF program in Lesotho, where the proportion of smear-negative TB increased from 5% in 2006 to 41% in 2009 after TB-HIV integration. And that is a sign that the nurses that were initially mostly diagnosing smear-positive TB, because TB programs, because the indicators they use are still very much geared towards smear-positive TB, with TB-HIV integration, they acquired the clinical skills to diagnose smear-negative and extrapulmonary TB better. And this resulted into this shift in proportions of smear-negative versus smear-positive TB. We also found in Lesotho that patients on ART had much better TB outcomes, probably because the adherence support structures available for ART did improve TB outcomes. You see that in the in red, you have patients not on ART, in green, patients on ART, and success rates in patients on ART were above 80%, whilst they were a mere 50% in patients not on ART. In Khayelitsha, we looked at the time from initiation of TB treatment to the time of initiation of ART, and found that in the same clinic, after integration, we reduced this time from 42 days to 26 days, and hopefully we can reduce it even more. Of course, the first question from any skeptic is, yes, but what about nosocomial transmission? Aren't you putting HIV positive, TB negative patients together with highly infectious TB patients? And the first response to that is that this happens regardless of TB-HIV integration. The most infectious patients are undiagnosed patients, and they are sitting together with your HIV patients already in non-integrated services. The lesson from that is that we need, and because nosocomial transmission is a serious concern in integrated and in non-integrated clinics, and we need to implement intensive infection control procedures in all clinic areas, regardless of integration. In high TB prevalence settings, there is also a lot of transmission of TB in the community. This is a slide before we implemented enhanced infection control, comparing TB incidence rates in an integrated versus non-integrated clinic, where they didn't find actually different rates of TB in both clinics. Infection control, well, first of all, what we did in Khayelitsha was to put in infection control policy to have aggressive education of patients via pamphlets, but also in the clinics, and to introduce personal controls via surgical masks for patients and respirators for staff. But the most important intervention is to increase the ventilation in the waiting rooms. Most clinics, or many clinics, are built with one central waiting room, and around them you have consultation rooms, and that waiting room has no windows or very little windows. What we did, and this is in rural Lesotho, is just changing the type of waiting rooms we have, with a lot of ventilation and with windows that you cannot close, hereby maximizing ventilation in waiting rooms. And I think that is probably one of the most efficient interventions to reduce nosocomial transmission at primary care. We do, as Tony said earlier, we are dealing also with the emergence of drug-resistant TB. Does drug-resistant TB change the fact that we need to integrate TB and HIV? I don't think so. I think the same principles that I described earlier apply for drug-resistant TB, and I won't go in detail in this today because I'm presenting tomorrow in session room 6 on a decentralized model of treatment of drug-resistant TB in Khayelitsha as well. The most difficult part to integrate, even in Khayelitsha, has been the monitoring. And why so? Because even though we managed to integrate TB and HIV clinics at primary care, we have to serve two very difficult masters: the National TB Program on one side, who wants monitoring to be reported in one way, and then the HIV program on another side, who wants ARVs and HIV outcomes to be reported in a different way. So we did manage to build an integrated database who can produce outcomes in one format for TB and in another format for HIV, but it still results in very big folders with TB stationary and HIV stationary. And I think one of the biggest barriers, and Lucy said that as well, to TB-HIV integration is the fact that we are still dealing with, at international level, WHO, HIV-AIDS department on one side, Stop TB department on another side. They say that integration is what we need, but are they integrated?
Sheer, 1 minute, please.
Yeah, I'm finishing. At national level, we have a national HIV program and national TB program, and at primary care, how can we integrate with such difficult masters? In conclusion, TB-HIV integration, and not just collaboration, that's what we need. It has a positive impact on HIV and TB indicators, improves clinical capacity in TB care and public health approach in HIV care, shortens the time to ART, which saves lives. Infection control is crucial regardless of integration, and the lack of integration of administrative structures is a barrier to integration at the clinical level. I want to thank all patients and staff in Khayelitsha, in Lesotho, and in other programs, as well as Eric Gumar, who helped me putting together this presentation.
Mm.
Gilles, thank you very much indeed for a very instructive talk. We move on to the next talk. I'd like to introduce Professor Gavin Churchyard, who is the CEO of the Arum Institute for Health Research that focuses on TB and HIV. He's also the chair of the WHO TDR Reference Group for TB, Leprosy and Borrelia Ulcer. And Gavin's principal research interests are in preventing tuberculosis in people living with HIV. Gavin's going to talk about the scientific perspective. Gavin.
Thank you, Tony. I'd first like to just thank the organisers for inviting me to give this presentation. I will focus on scientific advances of importance to decreasing the burden of TB in people living with HIV and decreasing the burden of HIV in TB patients. Specifically, I will talk about intensified case finding, isoniazid preventive therapy, and infection control, branded by the World Health Organization as the 3R strategy. I will also emphasize integration of activities at primary health clinics. I will also focus on integrated HIV and TB treatment. The number of people living with HIV screened for TB increased substantially between 2003 and 2008, although globally the number of people screened was only 4%. In Africa, this number was higher at 20%, which is still woefully inadequate. The number of people living with HIV started on IPT is very low. Globally, only 0.2% of eligible individuals were started on IPT. Moving on to intensified case finding. It is important to exclude active TB prior to starting IPT. A meta-analysis of studies done in Africa, Asia, and the Americas showed a range of TB prevalence of undiagnosed active TB from 0.7% in community-based TB prevalence surveys to 2.3% in primary health care clinics and PMTC clinics, 8.5% in VCT settings, and up to 25% prior to starting ART in African medical and ART clinics. The prevalence of undiagnosed active TB drops substantially once people enter HIV care and are started on IPT or ART with a prevalence of about 2%. As prevalence is the key determinant of transmission, screening, diagnosis, and treatment is essential to infection control. These results highlight the high burden of undiagnosed TB among people attending health clinic facilities and provides justification for screening all individuals attending healthcare facilities rather than just known HIV-infected individuals. Jules has just shared with us the Lesotho experience of providing a one-stop shop for integrated HIV and TB treatment and how community health workers providing intensified case finding increased the yield of tuberculosis cases, particularly of smear-negative TB. In 2007, the World Health Organization released guidelines to improve the diagnosis and treatment of smear-negative TB. A study presented at the recent South African TB conference showed that use of the WHO guidelines in hospitalized smear-negative TB suspects increased survival at 8 weeks post-admission from 68% prior to implementation of the algorithm to 84% after implementation of the algorithm. The Detect TB is a cluster randomized study of two periodic intensified case finding strategies conducted in Harare, using door-to-door inquiry for chronic cough compared to community mobilization and a mobile van for sputum collection. The results of the study showed that 6 monthly rounds of intensified case finding reduced the prevalence of undiagnosed active TB over a period of 3% over 3 years by 59% in HIV uninfected individuals and 22% in HIV infected individuals. Although the burden of disease is borne by HIV infected individuals, these results show the importance of HIV uninfected individuals in transmitting TB and provide further justification for screening all individuals presenting to healthcare facilities for TB to prevent transmission to healthcare workers and people living with HIV. We have just heard that early diagnosis and treatment of TB saves lives. A new point of care diagnosis, the KEFID gene expert, is now available in the field. And the preliminary results from the FIND demonstration projects has shown excellent sensitivity in smear positive and smear negative TB with a sensitivity of 99.5 and 90.2% respectively and a 97.5% sensitivity for the diagnosis of rifampicin-resistant TB. The pilot studies are underway of the KEFID gene expert system in primary health clinics. However, the cost of the system is prohibitively expensive, and if we wish to derive maximum benefit from this technology, we need to radically drive down the cost so that we can scale it out as a point-of-care test in primary health clinics and save lives. Moving on to isoniazid preventive therapy. Before starting IPT, it is important to exclude active TB. The World Health Organization and CDC conducted a meta-analysis of primary data from 12 studies to standardize screening for TB in people living with HIV. The analysis showed that the best rule was 1 of 4 of current cough, that is greater than 24 hours, fever, night sweats, and weight loss. The screening algorithm performed well in clinical settings with a sensitivity of 81% and a negative predictive value of 97.4. The negative predictive value is important as it determines the number of TB cases that will be missed with the screening algorithm for any given sensitivity and TB prevalence. The higher the negative predictive value, the fewer the number of TB cases that will be missed. The screening algorithm also worked well in individuals with advanced immune suppression with a sensitivity of 88% and a negative predictive value of 97.7. These results should give us confidence in excluding TB prior to starting IPT. Two retrospective studies have recently been presented showing the effect of IPT and ART on TB incidence and mortality. In the South African study, giving IPT prior to ART reduced the incidence of TB by 90% compared to those that did not receive IPT or ART and resulted in a greater reduction in TB compared to those that got ART alone. In another retrospective study in a workplace program, again in South Africa, starting IPT with antiretroviral therapy reduced mortality within the first year after starting ART by 53%. The results of randomized controlled trials are awaited, but these results support combined use of IPT and ART. The new WHO guidelines for IPT recommend IPT for all HIV-infected individuals, regardless of whether they are on ART or not. The results of two studies comparing 6 and 36 months of IPT have also been recently presented. The study from South Africa did not show a significantly greater reduction in TB incidence with 36 months of IPT in the intention to treat analysis, but did show a 69% reduction in TB incidence in the per protocol analysis. This apparent non-effect is due to poorer adherence and retention in the 36-month IPT arm. In the Botswana trial, in the intention to treat analysis, there was a 54% and in the per protocol analysis, 65% reduction in TB incidence with 36 months IPT compared to 6 months, with the greatest effect being observed in TST-positive individuals with TB incidence being reduced by 93%. The new WHO IPT guidelines make a conditional recommendation for providing at least 36 months of IPT. I will now discuss some aspects of infection control. Rod Eskom showed that using a CO2 diffusion model, that increasing natural ventilation by opening doors and windows increased the number of air changes per hour by more than twofold compared to mechanical ventilation. And again, as Jules has just shown us, we need to, where feasible in high TB prevalence setting, use outdoor waiting areas and open doors and windows. In studies of guinea pigs exposed to air from HIV-infected TB patients in Peru showed the potential benefit of ultraviolet light. The infection, TB infection in guinea pigs was reduced by 70% by ultraviolet lights. TB infection in guinea pigs was also associated with inadequately treated MDR-TB patients. These results are consistent with studies done in the late 1950s in guinea pigs showing that transmission of drug-susceptible TB can be rapidly and dramatically reduced with effective treatment. These studies suggest that in addition to administrative controls and improving natural ventilation, we must diagnose rapidly TB cases and start them on treatment. Moving on to integrated TB and HIV treatment. The SEPA trial evaluated integrated HIV and TB treatment in people living with HIV and a CD4 count less than 500. The sequential arm was compared to the combined early and late integrated arm. The integrated arm was associated with a 56% reduction in mortality. The results of the early and late integration arms is still awaited. Despite the controversy around this trial, results certainly highlight the importance of integrated TB and HIV treatment, which for the most part is still not happening in most of sub-Saharan Africa. The Camellia trial, which is comparing starting antiretroviral therapy at 2 or 8 weeks after initiating TB treatment in severely immunosuppressed HIV-infected Cambodian adults, will be presented on Thursday at this conference and provides further evidence for early integrated treatment. In conclusion, integrated TB and HIV activities still remain poorly implemented, but is improving. We must scale up intensified case finding, isoniazid preventive therapy, and infection control. All individuals presenting to health services should be screened for TB, and if found to have TB, started on treatment rapidly. The integration of ART with IPT and TB treatment also needs to be scaled up. Thank you.
Gavin, thank you very much indeed. And I'd like to introduce our last speaker, Kevin de Kock, who is director of the Center for Global Health, Centers for Disease Control Atlanta, a post I think he took up in May this year. Prior to that, he was director of CDC in Kenya, and prior to that, director of the HIV department in WHO. Kevin has a vast experience of TB-HIV issues at both policy and also field level, and he's going to talk to us about the policy perspective. Kevin.
Thank you very much, Tony. Colleagues, friends, good morning, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me. Bill Fagey, a former director of the Centers for Disease Control, has said that one of the functions of public health is to define the unacceptable, and I think that the HIV-TB situation is unacceptable. Obviously, a lot of issues have already been covered, and some of my comments I either would modify slightly or are going to be a bit repetitious, but nonetheless, I think many, many important points have been made. Nonetheless, if you accept that epidemiology is a science of comparison, a science of skepticism, and you know, skepticism is the chastity of the intellect and it should not be surrendered lightly, then we have a duty to question and probe, and this discussion on policy should start with the basic question, why integrate? And forgive the misquote from the great and greatly irreverent social critic Tom Lehrer. I don't know how many remember Vatican Rag. I think we've heard many good reasons to integrate. The most important are to achieve better health outcomes, greater client convenience, and cost savings. But these are not necessarily guaranteed, and they do need to be supported by data. And policymakers always need to be prepared for unintended consequences and actually take responsibility for them, measure them, and take corrective action. And these could include erosion of technical quality, such as loss of tuberculosis expertise, loss of accountability. If everybody does everything, then nobody is responsible for anything. And sometimes even reduced pride in specialization, as well as further spread of tuberculosis amongst the most vulnerable. So the reason to quote Tom Lehrer actually is to emphasize my first point, that that we need sound policy in global health, but not dogma, and we must maintain a constant questioning attitude. Now, some definitions. Policy is the elaboration of a course of action by authorities with regard to a particular set of issues. So faced with an escalating burden of tuberculosis, policy is about defining the what and why in a response. It leads to tools for implementation, such as regulations, rules, guidelines, protocols, which represent the how, the where, and the when of the response. We physicians and healthcare workers must recognize that health impact is actually greatest from non-clinical factors, many of them dependent on sound policy. At the base of this pyramid, you have social determinants such as housing, employment, alleviation of poverty, and then structural interventions, universal access policies, for example, seatbelt laws. Once-only public health interventions such as vaccination or male circumcision, clinical interventions such as taking tuberculosis therapy on a daily basis, and then at the top, behavioral change. But all of these, all of them, require sound policy. Few would probably disagree that science should drive public health policy, but all probably recognize that values and opinions influence decisions. Even evidence from studies may not be complete and is vulnerable to bias, confounding, and chance. Interpretation is still required, and we can never escape the need for judgment. Now, human rights are interesting because actually human rights, which fundamentally are a legal concept, have to be enshrined in policy. But some broad interpretations are really about values, such as the quest for social justice. And these affect policy, but their interpretation is diverse, and opinions, politics, and even religion in some settings play their part. But I do want to stress the importance of evidence. Decision makers have the right to their own opinions, but not to their own data. The photo actually illustrates an interesting challenge to policy, an example of this. It's of a guard outside a hospital in South Africa, where patients with MDR and extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis were isolated on a largely involuntary basis. And it highlights a particular policy question, the role of isolation for control of extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis, a subject on we have a paucity of data but an abundance of opinion. And nonetheless, sound policy in health based on the best available data should be seen as an individual human right and a societal right. If we think of integration between HIV and TB services, we've heard a lot about this. We can envisage several levels of integration. This slide was kindly given me some years ago by Jerry Friedland, who has contributed so much. Traditionally, we've seen two programs with very different philosophies and working styles, which when they realized that they could not ignore each other, initially rather inefficiently referred patients between each other. Some took the bold step of partial integration, and we've heard the truly innovative work from Khayelitsha by MSF and colleagues, and I do want to salute that work, for which I have high respect. Now, this is at the clinic level, but allusion has also been made at integration at the higher levels of the health sector, or even at the global levels. And I think we face a conundrum, despite, I appreciated the comments Gilles made. We face a conundrum because the majority of tuberculosis in the world, of course, is not associated with HIV. And the situation faced particularly by Southern Africa, which has the highest HIV and the highest TB rates in the world, independently, even before the AIDS epidemic, the highest TB rates, that situation is very, very unique. So what we could do better than we're doing, but on the right of the slide, you see a situation that maintains specialist expertise for both diseases, but integrates that expertise and in where it is necessary. And I think a useful topic for discussion would be to elaborate on what that actually means. Now, how this is done at country level varies tremendously by the individual context, and I think it would be dangerous to assume that there is a one-size-fits-all solution. What we can't allow to happen is erosion of technical expertise, including for the basics of tuberculosis control. The Stop TB strategy, which I strongly support, that was launched in 2006 by WHO and the Stop TB program, placed an emphasis beyond DOTS to include partnerships and system strengthening. And the TB community as a whole has increasingly adopted the advocacy and the rights-based approaches that traditionally were associated with the AIDS movement. At the same time, there may be a shifting of attention. I think we have seen this in some countries in Africa, a shifting of attention away from the basics of TB control that are just illustrated in one regard by the very specific recording and reporting requirements for individual TB patients that do commit the program to accountability to each and every patient. So paradoxically, in some settings, as TB programs become more human, and I use that term advisedly, in their concerns, there may also be a risk at the same time of losing quality for individual care. And that overall sentiment is captured in a paper actually written 18 years ago or so by the current CDC director, Tom Frieden, entitled "The Slippery Slope to Sloppy Dots." So the point I'm trying to make is that policy cannot be viewed in isolation from implementation, but that policymakers have a duty to review and evaluate the impact of those policies and their application in the real world to assure a maintenance of standards and avoid secondary unintended consequences. Policymakers also have an obligation to stay abreast of changing science and drive science to provide answers to the right questions. In other words, policy should be informed by evidence, but it also needs to stimulate the search for evidence. We've heard about the three I's prioritized by WHO in response to HIV-associated TB, and I won't say more about that. Now, perhaps no single event better demonstrated the danger of the uncontrolled intersection of HIV-AIDS, poor TB program performance, and absent infection control than the lethal outbreak of extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis among HIV-infected persons in Tugela Ferry in South Africa. And this experience showed that XDR-TB has the ability to turn HIV-AIDS into something for the last 29 years we've been saying it is not, a potentially fatal condition that can be casually transmitted. So addressing infection control for tuberculosis is critically important, and it starts with policy defining the what in relation to a new problem. Now, despite great progress towards the process indicators outlined under DOTS and the Stop TB strategy, TB control is not occurring at the rate hoped for or predicted, including in countries with low HIV prevalence. And this paper, which I urge you to read, published in Science just recently by Chris Dye and Brian Williams, explores some of the potential reasons. Ideally, we should be looking for game changers. A game changer is one of those fundamental, radical innovations that completely change the way that something is done, thought about, or made. A cell phone, I think, would be an example. The internet, antiretrovirals themselves. And for HIV-associated TB, it may be that antiretroviral therapy fits that bill, perhaps in combination with isoniazid preventive therapy. This conference has reviewed the prevention benefit of ART. I'll skip over that. This slide just refers to the mathematical model that WHO published in this regard. A separate but allied question is when to start antiretroviral therapy for individual health, and I think that's so important to this TB discussion. Practice in the North, based on observational data rather than on randomized trials, is leaving the WHO recommendation of starting at 350 cells per cubic millimeter behind. Starting ART immediately upon diagnosis and diagnosing HIV as early as possible for the individual could maximally benefit individual health, reduce HIV transmission, virtually eliminate mother-to-child transmission of HIV, and control HIV-associated tuberculosis through direct restoration of immune function and indirectly through the prevention of HIV spread. Gavin has already shown the results of the continuous versus 6 months INH preventive therapy study in Botswana by Samandari and colleagues, 93% reduction in TB incidence in skin test, tuberculin skin test positive persons. Now, how to best use ART and isoniazid preventive therapy together or alone for TB control is surely the most important question in this field. And we should not squander the opportunity for identifying and embracing what is potentially a game changer. I have some final comments before closing on the great responsibilities faced by policymakers and the need to hold them accountable. They say that if you kill one person, you go to prison. If you kill 30, you may go to a psychiatric asylum. If you kill thousands, you go into political exile. If you kill patients as a clinician, you can lose your medical license. And yet the impact of bad health policies are rarely quantified. And in this regard, getting it right for tuberculosis is particularly important in light of its unforgiving natural history. Poor policies and poor programs for malaria lead to a rapid rebound of disease that is readily apparent, may have severe consequences such as drug resistance, but in general is relatively rapidly susceptible to intervention. With TB, because of the persistence of latent infection, poor policies or program performance over even a few months can result in consequences such as persistent high incidence of disease and drug resistance, including multi-drug and extensively drug resistance, many years later, and set us back potentially for decades. In closing, what will it take? As always, it starts with evidence and data. Good science applied to the right questions. Clarity of thought, good judgment, balancing risk with what is reckless caution. Do no harm is something I certainly believe in, but do no harm is not an excuse for doing nothing. Policy sounds dry, but it's the basis for action. It cannot be dissociated from leadership, advocacy, and perhaps above all, vision. I think that with idealism that's tempered by evidence, that with pragmatism that is principled, with cautious optimism and vision, then in the words of Martin Luther King, our people will get there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kevin, for this fantastic presentation and summarized very well, I think, the balance that all of us are facing there. Thanks to all the presenters to stick to their time. It leaves us about 25 minutes for a debate. We'll stick to the three I's for the debates. We'll take the question one by one. The three I's are introduce yourself, be incisive and short, and the third one is indicate to who you address the question. We'll take them one by one. Okay, the first question is number nine.
Thank you for the interesting presentation. My name is Tom de Croo, and I work in Mozambique. My question is to Gilles. If we now integrate HIV and TB in one room, one nurse, what do we do with the policy of integration HIV in primary health care? Thank you.
Yeah, Tom, can you clarify that question a little bit? Because when
I'm sorry, I'm not used to speak to this micro with a lot of echo. So now in Mozambique, we do HIV service where we have TB. And we want to integrate HIV in the primary health care. This means that the nurse doing triage will also do HIV care, and that the TB nurse will treat all co-infected patients for HIV and TB. But you don't have a vertical service for HIV and TB only. You understand?
Yes, I do. So you're pushing it further from TB-HIV integration to integration of TB and HIV services in general primary healthcare.
It's a question, huh?
Yeah. No. Well, I think that really depends on the prevalence. I think in very high HIV-TB prevalence settings, you probably have such a high burden of disease that it is better to integrate TB and HIV, TB and ARV services. In low prevalence settings, I don't see why you couldn't pilot a model of integration of TB and HIV services in primary healthcare. I don't know if some of the other people on the panel have something to add on that.
No, we'll take another question, number six.
Thank you for the presentation. My name is Mary Tsuva from the University of Bergen in Norway. My question is cross-cutting to all the presenters. And I would like to know, how can we disentangle the misunderstanding that once a person is diagnosed with TB, they are automatically HIV positive? These are some of the perceptions the community has. How do we communicate to the community that it is possible to suffer from TB and also be HIV negative? And then the other part of the question relates to integration. The community has sort of a different understanding in terms of the two diseases. TB as a disease is not stigmatized, while HIV is stigmatized deeply for that case. And now when we are talking about the concepts of collaboration and integration, have we tried to find out which one the community prefers, whether TB and HIV should be integrated or they should remain apart as collaborators? These issues relate to access and utilization or acceptability of the services. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. I think I will allocate it to Lucy because it's mostly on the community perspective.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for those two interesting questions. I think the first thing that we actually need to do even at community level is actually break that myth whereby people always have that perception that if somebody has TB, they automatically have HIV. And data exists. In a country like Kenya, we are seeing a co-infection rate of 44% of actually TB patients being HIV positive. So it leaves you with the other bit of about 60%. So it doesn't necessarily mean that if you have TB, then you automatically have HIV. I guess I just want to pose back the question to you is, what would you do to be able to dispel that misinformation or the myth that exists in the communities? And I guess for me, the hugest thing is, what can we do more to be able to encourage people to go for both tests so that at the end of the day, you're ruling out HIV, even in a scenario whereby the prevalence could be pretty low. And then, of course, in relation to the concept of collaboration, many a times when we talk to the patient community groups, they would definitely prefer services being integrated together, because at the end of the day, there's added value, minimizing the time that is lost, patients having to go to different clinics. But that would apply in high TB HIV settings and not necessarily all around the areas or other countries. But at the end of the day, I think the importance of actually having integrated services has much more benefits than actually being able to have separate clinics.
Thank you. On number five.
Hello, I'm Saeed Ahmed. I work for BPI in Malawi. And two quick questions, one for Gil. Do you think it's as practical to have complete integration in settings where the incidence of TB is not as high as what you see in Khayelitsha and other areas of South Africa? And the second is if the panel could elaborate more on the practical aspects of integrating. At our PEDS clinic for a long time, we've been frustrated with the ability of the TB program to treat kids. And so we lobbied to provide TB treatment at our clinic. And everyone was in agreement, but it was the practicality, getting the TB drugs, filling out the TB registers. And it took us 3 years to do that. And even now, we can only initiate. They still have to go to the TB clinic for a continuation phase. So if you could comment a little bit on how practical this will be if we all agree that this is a good idea.
Well, so you're asking whether it's a good idea to integrate TB and HIV fully in lower prevalence settings, but Malawi is still actually a very high prevalence setting compared to other settings. I think in areas where TB, HIV co-infection is high, and Malawi is one of those settings, it makes perfect sense to fully integrate TB and HIV services, even in areas where it's a little bit lower than Khayelitsha, which is an extreme example. In very low HIV prevalent settings, I think it's a different question.
Thank you. As far as your first question about children is concerned, I mean, that would be an example of a local policy question that, you know, that could just be changed very rapidly so that children can access tuberculosis therapy where they get their HIV care in an integrated fashion. That's a local issue. But there's some general issues which I think are truly difficult, and I'm not sure we've got the answers. And what I'm thinking of is, you made reference to it, Gilles did, the issue of recording and reporting. You know, the tuberculosis system, the traditional TB system, has a very simple, very, very effective recording and reporting system that does assure accountability to each and every patient when it works. And it's kind of written in stone, and it's out there, and it's universal. In HIV, I think our monitoring of of therapy and recording and reporting of outcome is actually very poor. We've got many different systems, and it's kind of chaotic, and the data are not that great. And yet we have a problem, as has been pointed out, having these two different reporting systems. Now, how to move forward on that? On the one hand, should we have one universal system for reporting and recording for HIV? I'd be interested to see what our chairman thinks, who's written a lot about this. And how to then marry the two systems together, or indeed in something that's now as well established, long established as TB reporting, if it was better to change it in some settings because of HIV, how would we do that and who decides? I think there's many, many uncertainties there. I'd be interested to hear other people's opinion.
Next question is number three.
Anne Goldfeld, Harvard Medical School and Cambodian Health Committee. One brief comment and then a question for Dr. De Kock. The comment is that the SAPIT study addressed whether sequential treatment of TB and AIDS, what the impact of that was, whereas the results that will be presented tomorrow in the late breaker address the question of early at 2 weeks versus 8 weeks, initiation of heart in immunosuppressed TB patients with AIDS. And that's a very different question. So that's addressing the question of within the first 2 months when mortality is the highest, do you have an impact of going in with early heart? My question is, so we've been discussing integration of HIV and TB therapy and care, and one major issue is, of course, MDR and XDR TB, as has been mentioned by several of the panel members. And in a global situation where access to MDR TB is not accessible, basically, and I just bring to light one example from Ethiopia, which is just one in many examples where a country which has an estimated, by WHO standards, of 6,000 new MDR cases a year was approved in, I believe, in an approach of to do no harm for 45 courses of MDR treatment. And even those 45 courses, the procurement and access to those courses was delayed for over a year. So in this situation with burgeoning MDR and XDR TB and the tremendous impact and problems that creates for TB HIV management, what is your suggestion to get us out of this global catastrophe?
Thank you for the question. And there are related to HIV, but dissociated from HIV also, there are analogous problems. I mean, you could ask exactly the same question about what about the treatment of hepatitis B and hepatitis C, in injecting drug users in Eastern Europe, for example, or elsewhere. And we don't have the right answers. And, you know, I think HIV has offered us, by this focus on universal access to therapy, other doors are open that need, or other doors could be open that we need to push on, but it will take time. As far as XDR and MDR are concerned, I think it's very important to keep coming back to this. But two comments. Firstly, you know, MDR and XDR are humanly created by poorly functioning programs and poor accountability to individual patients. So, you know, we have to go full circle and strengthen our basic tuberculosis programs. Secondly, I do worry about blind treatment for drug-resistant tuberculosis. And this is a comment, it's an opinion, you know, it's a question, it's not a statement of fact. But are we doing the right thing in treating people without access to laboratory data for that particular condition? And I think that's a question that's amenable to research, and it's an urgent question.
The microphone is off.
My question is, in situations where there has been documented cases of MDR. And I can take Ethiopia as an example. There were over 200 documented cases, backlogged cases, waiting for therapy. And drugs were not in the country for a full year after their approval by the Green Light Committee. So my question, and maybe there's no answer to it, but I just want to raise the point that we, as a community, need to be really addressing the question of how to access therapy when, in fact, there has been good lab diagnostics and there are programs in place or can be brought to bear to distribute those drugs in a responsible fashion.
Okay, I think we need to move to the next question because there are a lot of questions waiting. Number six.
Sure, thank you. My name is Kedar Mate. I work for the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, an organization that focuses mainly on systems improvement. And I wanted to ask the question about the TB, HIV, lack of coordination, I should say, seems to me to be a product of system disintegration, and we've talked a lot about that already. In the final presentation, Dr. De Kock mentioned IPT as a potential game changer, but in the presentation that was given just before it, we saw the coverage of ITP being less than 1% worldwide. So my question is, do we not need another mechanism, a different game changer that looks at health system strengthening and possibly goes beyond the system solutions that we can come up with, but looks outside of healthcare to other systems that have greater reliability in service delivery? And the question, I suppose, is what are we doing in order to look at those other possible mechanisms for service delivery and improving that performance?
Just a comment around the IPT. So in order to get the impact at a population level, we have to scale up IPT massively, and the combined use of IPT and ART is complementary. So we are going to have to look at the health system, certainly, to strengthen it, and I believe that integration will be key to driving up usage of IPT. Maybe you can share with us some examples of other systems that improved service delivery. I mean, I know it's around like getting Coke to people in rural villages, and we want to get pills into people's mouths and vaccines into their arms. So maybe you can just share with us what you think.
But Kedda, just to feed back to this, I mean, it's an interesting point. Isoniazid is a TB drug and generally has been within the province of the TB control programs. IPT is in fact an HIV intervention given by HIV programs to people to stop them getting tuberculosis. So there's got to be a sort of mind shift here a little bit about the HIV programs, the HIV community taking a TB drug and being responsible for it. I know your question was broader than that, but sometimes it's the devil in the detail that's required to make these things happen.
I think the next one is number two.
Yes, Delphine Sculier from the World Health Organization. So as we have heard from the presentation and from the question from the audience, I mean, there is less likely that there will be one fit-size approach for the TB-HIV integration. And so I would like to bring the possibility of decentralizing antiretroviral therapy into the TB clinics. And Kenya has started to do so, so I would like to ask Lucy and Kevin if they have some details to share with us about programmatic challenges and also results for program results and patient results. Thank you.
I think I fully agree with you. The experience of Kenya has actually taught us, and this goes back to, when you look at Kenya as a country, we have 600 comprehensive care clinics that actually provide antiretroviral therapy. But if you're to make a comparison with the TB treatment sites, we have about 1,800. So at the end of the day, it really makes sense, and that's the reason why Kenya has actually been able to pilot the issue, the rollout of antiretroviral therapy in TB clinics in 3 provinces. And the results are quite impressive because at the end of the day, you're actually seeing patients not only benefiting from the services, but being able to live a very, very productive life, considering that denying or the aspect of integration in TB clinics, like rolling out antiretroviral therapy, then at the end of the day goes a long, long way in losing out on many, many patients. So I guess for us, the lesson learned is there's the need to ensure that all other TB clinics within the country, the 1,800 sites that are already providing TB treatment, should also start doing antiretroviral therapy.
So no other comments about Kenya. Number 5.
Yes, hello, thank you. My name is Gabe Shammy from the Makerere University UCSF collaboration. So I had a question for Gavin Churchyard about intensified case finding. Often it's presented as a strategy to be enrolled in HIV clinics as well as in congregate settings. And I was curious about your thoughts on strategic, targeted strategies for intensified case finding, both among HIV-infected and uninfected persons out in more community casual settings.
Thanks. I think there's a slight contradiction in your question in that you're talking about targeted and community-based. Certainly, I think the definition of intensified case finding needs to be broadened, and what you're really referring to is active TB case finding, where you go out into the community and you do broad-based TB screening, as I showed in the Detect TB. I think the evidence is emerging both from the Detect TB study and from another very large cluster randomized trial design of enhanced TB case finding called the ZAMSTAR study being done in Zambia and South Africa, will certainly give us very clear evidence of the benefits of a population level screening and the effect that that will have on TB incidence at a population level. But if we really want to have an impact at a population level, we have to screen very broadly and we need to have the tools to do it. And I think what was so good about the Detect TB was that it was a very simple, cheap and effective system.
Here's Jerry, up to you.
Thank you. It's Jerry Friedland from Yale University and Tagella Ferry Care and Research Collaborative. I wanted to, since I followed Ann Goldfield at the microphone, I want to make a comment about HIV-TB integration and how anxious we are to hear the results of the Camellia study. But in the SAPIT trial, there are two arms that are similar in that they are integration arms at different periods of time, an early and a delayed integration, so that we're awaiting those results also, and SAPIT is not finished at all. And it will probably provide similar, hopefully, or supportive information for the data from the Camellia trial. So that SAPIT is not finished. It's ongoing. It's just that the delayed or the sequential part of that study has been reported. So there will be more information coming. And I do agree that the issue of when to start within the context of tuberculosis therapy remains unresolved and really critically important. So I wanted to, in a sense, pull together a little bit of what this wonderful panel has discussed. There was a lot of similarities in presentations about integration and the need for flexibility in policy and practice based on the prevalence of the two diseases in different settings, the history of the healthcare system, the levels of training and resources and the funding streams. And I think it's very important to keep that in mind because there's so many differences in terms of the models of integration and levels of integration. And I think the Khayelitsha model and in Lesotho is going to be very, very hard to do in many places. But elements of it can still result in improved outcomes of both TB and HIV. And one has to be sensitive to the local circumstances in which these programs are developed. I wanted to say one more thing about the critical issue of both tuberculosis and HIV integration and also drug-resistant tuberculosis remains early identification. And in that is the really the pitiful way in which we still diagnose tuberculosis, and particularly drug-resistant tuberculosis. And that is changing rapidly. And in the short term, a lot of this issue will be addressed, I think, in answer to Anne's question, more successfully when we're able to make these diagnoses rapidly so that individuals can be treated appropriately or separated appropriately, and the circumstance of continuing transmission can be broken. And the third thing I wanted to mention was also came up, and that is that we tend to focus still so many of our activities in the clinical care setting, in the clinics, in the hospitals, where most of the tuberculosis and most of the HIV treatment occurs actually in community settings, and we'll continue to do that. And I think we don't and haven't adequately exploited certain strengths in resource-limited settings that actually don't exist in developed countries, and that is the strength of the family and the community. And for both of those diseases, I think there is this infrastructure. It's not the bricks and mortars infrastructure, but really a people infrastructure that hasn't been adequately exploited in terms of successful treatment and also identification of cases early. So we really have to, in terms of paradigm shifts and maybe not necessarily deal breakers, or I forgot the term that was used. Kevin, what was it? Game changers. Game changers. This all comes from sports analogy. Sports. More development of and support of programs that occur actually in the community for these two diseases, I think, is another relatively inexpensive and available way to go.
Thank you. I think we'll only have space for one last question. Number 9 over there. I'm sorry to say so, but we have a flashing screen that you don't see there, saying 1 minute left, and we are fortunate to be in this big room, but unfortunately it's booked for just after this session, so we'll have to be strict with time. Number 9.
Thank you very much. Mine is a quick one. My name is Zengani Chirwa, from HIV/AIDS Department in Malawi. My question is to the second speaker. I just want to find out, in terms of integration, how they have handled the procurement supply management system. I think Professor Harris alluded to the fact that IPT is essentially a TB drug, but now it has to be supplied in a sort of an HIV setting. So have they managed to integrate their PSM system? And if not, how are they handling issues of procurement and supply?
So, as I said, the integration in Khayelitsha is at the primary care level. The higher levels, there is still a national TB program and a national ARV program, and so they still have different supply chains, even though they use one central depot at provincial level. So you have different supply chains right now.
Okay, we'll have to close this session, unfortunately, now. And I invite the one who still wanted to raise some question to be in direct contact with a panel member and raise your question around the panel or outside this room. What to say in conclusion? Well, I paraphrase you, Kevin. Maybe it's a subject where there is an abundance of opinion and a paucity of data, so we'll probably have to work on bringing more model, not one size fits all. It was said it's a regional problem for where the co-infection is extremely high. It's not the case for the whole world. And I'll finish there. It is happening. It is happening. We heard the story about Kenya wanting to decentralize ARV service within every single TB clinic in South Africa. You heard the Minister Motsoaledi said clearly that's one of the priority objectives is to bring ARVs in every single TB clinic. So instead of being, I think, reluctant and conservative, we'd better to take the bull by the horn and prepare what will happen there. And it will happen, I would say, in a correct way, Lucy, if, as you said, and I'll finish there, if patient and people living with HIV and TB have a voice and articulate this voice to say it should happen more rapidly and without drug failure. Thank you for your participation. It was a lively debate, as usually, and we'll close it here.